Guest number 2. Chapter 3, The Little Figures That Are Not There.
What I notice about Wiles Weeding is, you know, so that's something that I was always thinking about. How he talked about how when a child is not, you know, walking at a certain age or talking at a certain age or something, the child is being considered as not normal. Every parent is wondering, what is normal? And if my child is not, you know, talking at a certain age, is that not normal, or is that just my child being my child? What do you guys think? And how can you relate this into statistics and math?
Well, I think, like, if a statistic has, like, a certain, like, idea of what normalcy is, and they're trying to prove that idea, but, like, that idea could just be their bias. Like, as you said, like, what's normal can just be their bias. Like, I was looking at a statistic the other day, and they said they researched 138 countries, and they said that Latin America was the country that was the most positive. Like, they had the most positive emotions, like, the most positive experiences. But I was like, what is considered... Are you sure it's considered positive? Because, like, how do we know that? What is considered positive emotions? Positive experiences?
Or what is considered negative?
The fact that, you know, most of South America is impoverished, there's, like, rebellion, wars, slavery, all this kind of crap. You know, what is positive emotions really signify? Positive emotions can be disassociative emotions, you know? It doesn't always mean sincerely positive.
I was thinking about the, like, 68, 85, 99.7 rule. And when, in comparison with the child, where does the child fall on the normal, like, if it was to be graphed as a bell curve or whatever, where does the child fall compared to how does their parents see them? And in comparison, is it still considered normal or not?
So when talking about how one assesses normality or positivity, I was wondering, like, what type of people are they examining? Like, what type of data are they collecting? Like, how do they go about, you know, assessing normality? What is normal and what's not normal? Like, how do they know that around 4 months or whatever, babies should start moving, or, like, you know, or, like, around 1 year's old, baby should learn how to walk? Like, what do they test to make that, like, the normal?
Yeah, Jamika brought up a good point when she said about how do they know, because when I used to be younger, I used to go to the doctor, and the doctor would tell me, oh, because I'm 5'8 right now, and the doctor would tell me, oh, you're taller than the average kid, and he would sit there, and, like, I remember he showed me a paper where there was, like, a line of where I should be, and I was always above that line, and I always felt like I wasn't normal. So, but I never got a chance to ask him what is normal, and I don't know. It's just like, I feel like just because I'm not as tall as an average 6-year-old or 7-year-old doesn't mean I'm not normal.
My question is, how far back has this data been proven to be normal? And how many trials or graphs was created to conclude the data that they've collected?
And then there's, like, the other question, like, how do they get the data? The sample size. What types of people? Do they have a bias on what types of people they interview? In reference to the case of the survey of Latin America being the most positive country in the, you know, world, what types of people do they interview? They can favor certain types of people. You never know. And what the thing is these researchers, they get paid to prove theses for people who write articles for newspapers, and the people who write newspapers, they want something. They need a story. It's their job to get a story out there, one that, you know, keeps people interested, like, keeps people feeling good about things, you know, the world and all. So, you know, that is a large effect on the outcome of, like, data or what's normal.
In conclusion to this normality discussion, I went along and just found the definition of what normal is, and I came across, it says that it's conforming to a standard, the usual, the typical, or the expected. So that's just something to think about.
Chapter 5, the G-Wiz graph.
Let's talk about how bar charts and pictorial graphs should have areas proportional to values and not make comparisons in one dimensions, but also two or three dimensions.
As I was reading, I came across this topic. It's called visual impressions, and it basically talks about how, you know, society and, you know, Americans tend to show something that's not really true by making it look bigger.
Okay, so in the picture, there's two men. One man, he has 1 sack of money. The other, he has 2 sack of monies. And then there's another picture where one man has, like, a nice, small-sized stack of money, and the other one has, like, a gigantic stack of money. So basically it was saying, like, in the picture where the two men have, like, the same size stack of money, it doesn't, like, really show a difference.
Yeah, that the other, it doesn't really show that the other man has more money than him. They basically have to exaggerate. Like, that's what they did. They're exaggerating the picture.
Yeah.
They're basically making, for the second picture that she talked about, they have a small bag with the man laying on it, like sad, but they have a huge bag with the other man laying on it, and he's happy. So it just shows that, oh, I'm, like, more rich than the other picture shows. Basically, it's just, like, tricking people into thinking that, you know, that he has more than what it says.
What I get from this picture is, like, one man that has the smaller sack of money that they were talking about previously, he looks like he works for his money, because in the other hand, he has a saw and he, like, has a hat or whatever. Like, he looks like a handyman, possibly. And the other man that has 2 sacks of money, he doesn't look like he has to work very hard. So that's why what we notice, that the man that has a bigger sack of money that's just, like, chilling, the man that doesn't, that does have to work for his money, he's, like, astounded that he has so much money. He's like, how do you get this money from not doing, so, like, the work that I do? And it could have something to do with the previous reading, with the IQ levels, or maybe where this person comes from and their school background.
In page 68, there's a graph that shows the average dollars per week of Rotundians versus Americans. And it says that the Rotundians earn $30 per week and the Americans earn $60 per week. And below that, there is, like, a little graphic of a Rotundian with a 1 bag of money and an American 2 bags of money.
Which is what we've been talking about this entire time.
And what the purpose of this chapter is trying to say, they're trying to say that a visual representation can skew and definitely misinterpret the actual graph. Because on the second page, as Tyler, Jamaica, and Miriam had explained, there is a graphic of the Rotundian with a small amount of small money bag, and then the American with a huge money bag. But statistically, there's only a 2-to-1 difference between the Rotundian's pay and the American's pay. So this graphic on page 69 over-exaggerates the wealth difference between Americans and Rotundians.
Chapter 7, the semi-attached figure. If you can't prove what you want to prove, demonstrate something else and pretend that they are the same thing. In the days that follows the collusion of statistics with the human mind, hardly anybody will notice the difference. The semi-attached figure is a device guaranteed to stand you in good stead. It always has. To me, what this means is, this is what statistics been doing this whole time. It's not, it's kind of confusing because it doesn't always have the right facts, but it uses something else to prove what they want to prove, which makes it a little confusing for me personally, because if it's not the exact thing, why should I believe it?
Mm-hmm.
This quote left me wondering whether many people use this strategy when collecting data. I know that sometimes when I have a hard time finding statistics to back up my data, I research topics that are close to what I'm looking for, and I use that data to back up my hypothesis.
So what I get from them doing this is it creates a distraction for people that do not know what she's supposed to be looking for or what she's doing. And by finding data that is closely representing hers, it gives you the impression that she's correct, but she's not. So this leads me to wonder if when we go back and think about all the data that has been collected to prove something is normal or something is not or what something should be, was it something that they like that was closely related to what they had, or was this an actual proven fact that this is normal or this is correct?
I think the nostril examples, just like hand sanitizer examples, I mean, you can't prove that hand sanitizer will kill all the harmful germs that could, you know, get you sick, you know, cause, like, you know, cold, all that stuff, but they say it can, they say it's proven to kill 99% of germs on a surface, but what, you don't, you never know what type, and you don't even know what type of surface. Is it a cold surface, a hot surface, is it skin, or is it just a table? You never know that. And what, so since they can't prove that hand sanitizer will actually kill all the germs on your hands, they just say, oh, well, it kills 99% of germs because we tested it on something that you don't know.
This goes back to, like, when comparative studies are conducted among products, treatments, or groups. What is the comparison product, the treatment, or the group? So, like, in this chapter, the points that I got from it was how you target a population, you study the population. You, if you cannot figure out how to, like, compare the studies that you came across, you can trick people to believe that you have. And how you can control for all, like, other potential risk factors when studying effects of factors.
On page 76, I came across this very interesting topic. 27% of large sample eminent physicians smoke throaties, more than any other brand. The figure itself may be phony, or of course in any of several ways, but that really doesn't make any difference. The only answer to figure so irrelevant, so what? With all the proper respect towards the medical profession, do doctors know any more about tobacco brands than you do? Do they have any inside information that permits them to choose the least harmful amount of cigarettes? Of course they don't. And your doctor would be the first one to say so. The 27% somehow manages to sound as if it meant something. What I'm getting from this is that just because you're a doctor and you're chosen to smoke a certain brand of cigarettes doesn't mean that it's the best brand for the rest of us. Just because you have the name doctor doesn't mean we should believe everything that you say. And any doctor would say that cigarettes are not good for you, period. So why should I believe what you said? And 27% is not a good enough, you know, amount for me to believe that throaties is the best cigarettes or the safest or less harmful cigarettes to smoke.
Yeah, people in authority, when I feel like when they say something is good for you, then people are most likely to believe it, and that's what a lot of researchers and people ahead of companies use, such as the doctors ahead of corporate, the doctors saying they prefer certain tobacco brands over others. Just like with toothpaste, dentists prefer a certain brand, Colgate, over Crest. What about you guys? What do you guys think? Do you guys agree?
I do agree, because when I watch commercials and stuff like that, they make sure to put doctors in there. Oh, is doctor approved? But to me, it really doesn't, you know, mean anything to me personally, like whether it's doctor approved or anything, because, you know, you're a scientist. You're a doctor. You should know. If you're smart enough to make a brand that's going to be helpful for the rest of us, why aren't you smart enough to figure out that it is the right brand? Why do you need a doctor's approval for this brand? Because you have to be a scientist. You have to get a certain education for you to know what to put out there. So it just doesn't make sense to me. But I guess that's what the public needs to get a little approval, because they only trust doctors. But to me, personally, it doesn't matter. What do you guys think? Jamaica, what do you think about this?
I don't know. I think I agree with it, too, because, like, well, actually, I don't know. I'm somewhere in the middle, because I kind of agree that if doctors say, or, like, or dentists say that Colgate is better than all the other brands, I will use Colgate, because, like, I mean, because, like, there's dentists, like, they know how to take care of teeth and everything.
But so who do you think creates Colgate? Like, a guy from the street? Like, no.
No, a smart person. Well, you know, they created Colgate, and I don't know, they've done research.
It has been proven so many times that what doctor says has been wrong. Not every time that a doctor says something means that it's right. Like, it was so many times I go to a doctor, and he tells me to use this certain brand, but that brand doesn't always work for me.
Personally, I believe that people are paid to say anything. So someone can tell me that Colgate is better than Crest, but it wasn't scientifically proven that this is better than that. I mean, you can ask your dentist, well, you can ask a doctor. They do say that, but if you read the facts and what's good for you and what's good for your body or whatever, it can be something totally different than what they're told to say. I feel like if you think about it, anything can be a lie, and you would never know.
And I think that the human body is different, and everyone can handle different things. So I don't think one doctor could tell the whole world what's good for them, because you didn't talk to them personally. You didn't, like, you know, check them personally. So I don't think that, you know, it's right.
All right, so let's talk about casual relationships and how correlation does not imply causation. When you hear the word causation, what do you think of?
When people think of the word causation, I mean, what comes to mind first is what has caused a certain thing to happen, a certain event to occur.
Right, I agree with that. Like, when I hear it, I think, like, because of this, this happens. Like, this situation caused this to happen. So, it's like a cause.
Like, causation. Like, a concrete example of causation would be dairy and acne. There's been a strong link to it for the past century, and they've proven that there is dairy as direct causation of acne.
That was podcast 2.